I don't know if you were paying attention to the screen there, but when you look at those statistics, they're really pretty much overpowering and overwhelming. And what a strange way to start our year. And I want to say hi to our friends at Brownsbridge and at Buckhead Church as you join us this morning. And Happy New Year to you if I hadn't a chance to say that yet. When you look at those statistics, it's overwhelming. And let me just sort of vent a little bit about my perspective on all that. I get overwhelmed by all that. I don't know if it's an age thing. I think it's a little bit of an awareness thing. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I get overwhelmed by that. I get overwhelmed by the combination of what happens in our 24-hour news cycle. You know, we know about every national disaster, an international disaster. We see pictures, cholera outbreak in Haiti, as if Haiti needed that, and on top of everything else in Haiti. Every tsunami, child trafficking, drug addiction, divorce rate, what happens with children, pictures. I mean, I don't know how you respond to that. I mean, I think some people just shut it off. If you have a compassionate heart, it's just heartbreaking. You can hardly watch the news. You can hardly read any of that. And then to compound that with the personal tragedy you know about, you hear about a neighbor who's getting divorced. You hear about a neighbor who's got a very, very sick child. You have a neighbor who, they have an only child, and their only child was in an automobile accident, not sure they're going to survive. They just found that out this weekend, friend of ours. And again, then so-and-so's having trouble in their marriage, and can you come over here and talk to us? And I have a prodigal son or a prodigal daughter, or pray for my grandmother or my grandchild. And where I live, you know, with my job, and you know, in addition to all the stuff we all know about, and in addition to all the personal stuff, there's all the stuff that filters into our office and into our church because we're a large church. And it's like really every single day in my life, it's somebody's new tragedy, somebody's new cancer, somebody's new divorce, somebody's new family breaking up. And then on top of that, just all the needs in the world and all the statistics, and it's just overwhelming. And for me, and maybe, you know, you're not this way, I just get frustrated because I realize I can't do anything about any of it, none of it. I'm like you, I've done some traveling in the world, and I've been in some third world countries in some of the worst parts of the world. And you look at the poverty and you just think, gosh, short of just a big lot, you know, a whole lot of yellow, big yellow machinery where we could just bulldoze the whole thing and start over, what is the solution to this? And you know, government agencies all over the world have thrown gazillions of dollars, you know, after every kind of level of poverty and, you know, trying to deal with epidemics and all the stuff. And it just goes on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, what do you do with that? And again, depending on your personality, you respond in different ways. Some of you are like, well, Andy, just get over it. Just go back to work and quit reading all that stuff. And, you know, there's part of me that would like to do that, just like to shut the whole thing down and not pay any attention. But I'm a Christian. Most of you are Christians. And you can't do that. You're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to do that. But at the same time, we can't solve any of this. And, you know, here as we begin a new year, part of this new year is more of that, isn't it? More divorces, more families breaking up, more national disasters, international disasters, more famine, more heartbreak, more government, you know, in some other country misusing their funds while their kids starve and people starve and kids that need to be fostered and, you know, kids that are abandoned. It's just going to be more and more and more of that. And what do you do with that? And I think part of the problem for all of us is awareness, this issue of awareness. A long time ago, some of you can remember this. All of our grandparents remember this. A long time ago, the only poverty you knew about was the poverty you saw. A long time ago, the only divorces you knew about were the divorces that were, you know, in your immediate family. The only national, you know, the only natural disasters were the natural disasters that affected your city or your state. Or maybe you read a newspaper article about something in some other city and there was a little black and white picture of a snowstorm and that was about it, right? And we just didn't know what was happening all over the world. And consequently, we were able, I think, better to manage the drama of our own communities and our own towns and maybe even our own countries. But a long time ago, there just wasn't the awareness of all the junk that happens in the world all at once. And yet every time we turn on the television or the radio or drive, you know, somewhere or listen to somebody talk, it's just more and more and more and more and more. And what do you do with that? What do you do with that? And we can't shut it off. I mean, it's tempting. We shouldn't shut it off. We're Christians. And then to kind of infuriate some of us, and I don't want to get off on this because it kind of becomes a personal rant. Then there's this whole thing in our particular culture of this what I call misguided compassion, where people, in an attempt to be compassionate, do the very thing that exacerbates the problem. And in attempting to help people, we actually hurt people, but we feel good because we had a short-term solution, but we created more long-term chaos. It just makes it worse. And now another generation is going to face some of the same stuff that our generation faces, but only worse. And there's really nothing, honestly. I mean, you may be a rich, powerful person, but there's nothing you can do, really. You may be able to do more than me, but you can't fix it. And I can't fix it. And what do you do with that? But more specifically, what do we as Christians do with that? Because it's absolutely overwhelming, and we can't ignore it, and we can't pretend like it's not there, but we can't solve it. We can't fix it. We can't one-on-one and on our own change the world. Now, if you can identify with anything I've just said, and if that stirs up anything in you, I'm glad you're here today, because that's what I want to talk about. If you're kind of sitting here like, wow, could you just talk about something happy? Could we just get this thing? This is going to end happy. But I just kind of want to stir up this thing that at some point you felt at some level as you watch the news or as you get a phone call or as you kind of wait for the other foot to drop or, you know, whatever it is that it's going on in your life. And the good news is in the scripture, we're given a clue as to what to do. And so here's what I want to do on our first morning, our first day together as we begin this new year. I want to look at a passage of scripture where Paul gives us a clue. Then I want to give you a simple statement that I've been living with for a long time, and then I want to tell you a story about how this played out in my own life. The passage is actually found in Galatians chapter 6. If you have a Bible and want to follow along, I just want to read two or three verses, and then I want to give you a statement, then I want to tell you a story. In Galatians chapter 6, Galatians is actually a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to a group of Christians, and in this letter he talks about many, many different things, but there's this little chunk of verses, these few sentences that sort of center in on this whole thing of what is our social responsibility and what is our responsibility to other people in light of the fact that we really can't change the world and we really can't solve every social ill that bothers us or that plagues our society. And here's how it begins. He says this, let us not, and I love this first phrase, let us not become weary in doing good. I love that. Because some of us are designed and wired in such a way that we can become weary of doing good. And doing good in this particular context is a broad context. He's talking about being good morally, good ethically, good to other people, just doing good, whatever good is. He says, don't become weary in doing good, which I love because you know what? At some point, you just get tired of being good, don't you? You get tired of being generous. You get tired of serving other people. You get tired of caring. You get tired of being engaged. You get tired of being, you know, paying attention. He says, don't become weary in doing good, for at the proper time, he'll come back to that word in a minute, at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. And Paul says, I understand the weariness that comes with caring. I understand the weariness that comes with carrying other people and their burdens. And I understand the weariness that comes with just the information, the overload of, God, what's going on in the world and why can't I seem to solve it? He says, but don't become weary in doing good. In other words, to a certain group of you, he's saying this, don't disengage. Don't say, you know what? I can't do anything about it, so I'm not even going to look. I can't solve it, so I don't even want to know about it. It just bothers me. It just stirs me up on the inside, so I just want to shut it out. He says, no, you can't do that. You've got to stay engaged. You've got to stay involved. And don't grow weary in doing good, because over time, in time, there's a payoff. There's a payoff. There's a reward if you won't grow weary. Then he goes on and he says this. Therefore, as we have opportunity. And the little Greek word translated opportunity right here really means time. In fact, almost everywhere else in the New Testament and in other translations of the New Testament, this little word is translated time. He says this. Now, I don't want you to grow weary. I know there's a temptation to grow weary and you just get tired of everything that's going on. But therefore, as you have opportunity or as you have time, and here's how he finishes it out. Therefore, as we have time or as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. He says, as you consider your time and your opportunity, and you have limited time and you have a limited opportunity, but as you consider the pace of your life, as you consider the margin of your life, as you consider the time in your life, as you have opportunity, as you have time, as God gives you opportunity, as God gives you time, do good for other people, especially those who are part of the household of faith. Earlier in the book, he says this as well. He says, carry each other's burdens. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way, you will fulfill the law of Christ. My point is simply this. In the New Testament, we're taught, the Apostle Paul says it so clearly here, that in spite of the fact that there are problems we can't solve, in spite of the fact that there are issues that we will never be able to fully address so that those problems go away forever and ever and ever, you're responsible and I'm responsible to do what I can for someone somewhere. That with my little bit of extra time, as I have opportunity, as God gives me opportunity, I can't shut my eyes to the needs of others. I can't become so overwhelmed with the magnitude of the problems around me that I miss the opportunity that I have to do something for someone. And so for a very long time in my life, my approach and my way of addressing the overwhelming need, because I promise you, if you think you get overwhelmed, you just need to come spend a week at a local church and just see what happens. The only way that I've been able to survive this is to do something that I want to teach you today, and I want to give it to you in the form of a phrase. And the phrase is simply this: do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Would you just, everybody just say this with me? Do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. One more time. Do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Now, the reason I love this phrase, part of it is it flies in the face of something that I heard 1,000 times as a child and you heard 1,000 times as a child. And when you heard this as a child, it made you mad. And now that you're an adult, you say it. And we need to all quit saying it. And you know what I'm talking about. Because you go to your teacher and you'd say, "Teacher, can I do such and such?" And the teacher would say, "Well, if I let you do it, then I have to let everybody do it." And you'd go to the coach and say, "Coach, can I have one of those?" And the coach says, "Well, if I give you one, I got to give everybody one." Then you go home and you say, "Mom, is it okay?" "No, if I let you do it, then I got to let your brothers and sisters do it." And throughout our childhood, people use this ridiculous, it's not even rational, this ridiculous phrase that if I do for one, I have to do for everyone. And I know what you thought when they said that to you, because I thought the same thing. "Well, if I let you go, I have to let everybody go." And what did we think? No, you don't. You can just let me go. And here's the deal. I won't tell anybody. You don't tell anybody. Who in the world said if you let me go, you have to let everybody go? If you give me one, you got to give everybody one. Where in the cosmic, you know, where did that come from? I don't see anybody standing here with a gun to your head. Look, just let me in. Just let me go. Just give me one. Make me the exception. You don't have to do for everyone what you do for one. Just do it for the one, right? And so what happens, I think, for some of us is that way of, "I do it for you, I got to do it for everyone. If I do it, you know," we kind of bring that into our adult life and we look around and we miss this powerful, powerful idea that your responsibility and my responsibility is to do for one what we wish we could do for everyone. And not allow ourselves to become so overwhelmed with the fact that we can't do for everyone that we do for no one. And I'm telling you, so many of us and so many Americans, I think, have been so overwhelmed with need, 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 and poverty, and drug trafficking, and sex trafficking, and on and on and on. It goes, it's just kind of like, you know what? I can't solve it. I can't fix it. So I'm going to do for no one because I can't do for everyone. And if you're a Christian, you can't crawl into that little hole and hide. Because you have a responsibility and so do I. And I think the solution is for you to ask the question, who's the one? I can't do for everyone. But who's the one I could do for what I wish I could do for everyone? I've been doing this for years and years and years. And I teach our pastors this and I try to teach our staff this. Another illustration this past year, a friend of mine who says that I was instrumental in him coming to faith. We met on the baseball field where our kids played baseball. And he said, "Andy," he said, "would you baptize me?" I said, "I would love to baptize you. You got to go through Starting Point. And when you get through Starting Point and you get some of your questions answered, I'll baptize you." And so when our team that does baptism and when some of the people around me heard about this, they said exactly what they should say. They said, "Andy, if you baptize him, everybody's going to want you to baptize them." And I said, "And I wish I could baptize everybody, but I can't. But I'm not going to do for no one because I can't do for everyone. So I'm going to baptize my friend and then I'm just going to say no to everybody else. It's okay. I'm fine with that. That's what I want you to do. I want you to do what you can for one. I want you to do for one what you wish you could do for everyone, knowing that you can't do for everyone, but never, never use that as an excuse to do for no one. Now, people say, well, that's not fair. Here's a newsflash. Don't even try to be fair. Never be fair. Never, ever be fair. God's not fair. Mama wasn't fair. Daddy wasn't fair. Life's not fair. Forget fair. It's not about being fair. It's about doing the right thing. And if you're going to be fair, then you'll do nothing. You won't do anything for anybody because you can't do it for everybody. If I let you go, I got to let everybody go. You knew that wasn't true as a kid. Don't buy into that as an adult. Do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. And here's why I wanted to start the year this way for all of our churches and all of our congregations. Because my prayer for you, and I thought about this all throughout the fall as I knew we were headed toward this Sunday. My prayer for you this year is going to be that during the year, God nudges you. That during the year, you're going to see that one, you know, single mom. You're going to see that one struggling family. You're going to see that one group of kids. You're going to see that one guy in your office. You're going to see that one executive in your office. You're going to see that one group of kids. You're going to see that one age group. You're going to see that one children's home. You're going to see that one person struggling physically. You're going to see that one person, that one individual, that one category, and God's going to nudge you, and God's going to say, that's your one. Now, I want you to do for that one what you wish you could do for everyone. And don't use the excuse that since I can't do it for everybody, I'm going to do it for nobody. Now, I want to give you three tips as you apply this, and I want to tell you a story. Three tips. Tip number one, go deep rather than wide. Go deep rather than wide. In other words, if you have a passion for high school kids or middle school kids, because when you were in high school and middle school, your life was a disaster, and you just have a burden for middle school and high school kids, then what you need to do is find you a little bitty group of high school or middle school kids and go deep with them. Don't just have a general concern about high school and middle school kids. You need to get you a group and go deep with them. Don't just be concerned about the plight of people who are poor. You need to find a person or two that are poor, and you need to go deep with them. In other words, and our tendency is to go wide, not deep. And the reason is because wide is easier. It's just easier. Wide is I'm going to give you $10 and give you $100 and give you $15. I'm going to pray with you once. I'm going to pray with you once. I'm going to pray with you once. I'm going to be wide. I'm going to feel good about myself, but I'm not going to really do any good. To do for one what you wish you could do for everyone means you've got to go deep rather than wide. That's where the difference is made. Number two. You got to go long-term rather than short-term. In other words, this is a big-time commitment. You go long-term rather than short-term. This is one reason that when a person decides to take on an upstreet group in our church, you stay with that group of kids all the way through elementary school. When somebody plugs into a middle school group here, we want you to go all the way through middle school with them. Same with high school. We know that in terms of making a difference, to do for one what you wish you could do for everyone requires time. Many of you who've been a part of our global X trips, isn't it interesting? You go back to the same country over and over and over. That's going long. That's going deep instead of going wide and going short. Donna and Tom McMurray, they've been to a country in Southeast Asia several dozen times. Several dozen times to Indonesia. Why? Because they're going deep, not wide. They're going long. They're not going short. That is when God nudges you, and it's not just a category anymore. It's a face. It's that mom and her son, or that mom and her daughter. It's that struggling couple. You can't do marriage counseling for everybody. You're not even a marriage counselor. In fact, your marriage isn't even all that hot, but you got a burden for this couple. You go deep, you go long. And third, you go time, not just money. Time, not just money. Now, this is hard for us Americans. Because we're rich. You are rich. You have change in your ashtray, okay? That's how much money you have. You keep money in a trash can, okay? That's rich you are, okay? And us rich Americans, and this isn't bad, we love to give $100 to everything. And if you think of my world, you know, we do these global X trips where we send people on short-term missions. Do you know how many requests I get at home for short-term missions? I get one for all of them. And if there's 20 kids going on in the same trip, I get something from all 20 kids times however many trips we do. And I love giving 20, you know, in the old days, I'd say $300. Then there'd be eight more. I'm like, oh, can't keep doing that. So, you know, if you got there last, we just threw yours away. You know, then finally I thought, okay, I got to come up with a better system. So I'm all for, you know, giving as much money broadly, you know, as you can. But I'm telling you what, Don't use the money excuse to keep from investing your time. Do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. Go time, not just money. And I'm not trying to tell you where to give your money. I'm just saying find the one group, the one person, the one issue, the one need, the one organization, the one kid, the one couple, the one guy, the one struggling marriage, the one whatever it is. And make a commitment to go deep, to go long, to go time. And of course, you'll go money. But it's easier for us to... I've had people tell me, Andy, do I have to come to the fundraiser? Can't I just write a check? It's just the way we think. But here's what I'm telling you. As long as you minister, as long as you give of yourself only in that way, you miss an incredible opportunity. So here's my story. In 1986 or 87, that's the part I'm not sure about. Somewhere in 1987, 20-something years ago, I was working for my dad. I was single. I was doing student ministry downtown at my dad's Baptist church. And sometimes I would preach for him on Sunday night. The church was down on Peachtree Street. Some of you remember that. And because we were on Peachtree Street, we were very accessible to street people. Okay? A church is the only, you need to know this, a church... The reason churches attract wacko people sometimes, a church is the only place you can get into a large congregation for free. Every place else you have to buy a ticket. But a church is the only place you can get into a gathering for free. So sometimes we just attract interesting people. Okay, sometimes we hire them. So anyway, just kidding. So one Sunday night, I preached for my dad, and what would happen is we'd have an invitation. We're a Baptist church. So at the end of every service, no matter what the sermon was about, you could come forward and join the church or get your needs met, or we'd pray for you, or you could become a Christian. You know, we always did that. So on Sunday night, typically, we'd have one or two people from the street who had just wandered in, sat on the back row. They would come forward, and I'm not making fun, but if you get calloused after a while, they wanted to become a Christian, rededicate their life. They'd be whatever we wanted them to do, they would do as long as we'd feed them and put them up for the night. They were wide open. They loved Jesus. They loved us. We'd just help me, okay? This was, you know, so, and we were equipped for that. We tried to do what we could for homeless people. So one Sunday night, and again, you get a little callous because here comes another person and you smell them before you see them. And it's just, but we're downtown, but that's okay. We were trying to figure it out. So one Sunday night, I preached a sermon. I'm headed back, and there was a lady, way overweight. She'd been on the street. You could just not pretty sight at all. Looked like she was about 60. Turned out she was 40. She was waiting for me at my dad's office door where I was going back after the service, and she was standing there, and she said, "Preacher?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Yeah." And I thought, you know, money, what, you know. She said, "Do you really believe what you just preached?" And I said, "Yeah." And I had preached about forgiveness and being set free of bitterness and God setting you free and all these wonderful things that we as Christians believe. She said, "Do you really believe that?" I said, "Yeah, I do." She said, "Well, I need to talk to you about that." Of course, I'm thinking, yeah, well, I got to get home to my wife. And, well, I actually wasn't married. I don't know where I was going. I need to, you know, I had somewhere to go, okay? I may have said that. I don't know. You know, I got to go. I'm busy, you know. So I said, but, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, let's talk. So we sat down for a minute. Her name was Jane. What I didn't know was that was the beginning of a relationship that would last over 20 years. Her name was Jane McCall. And as I listened to Jane, something in me, sometimes you just get a nudge. I can't explain it. I thought, okay. And I didn't think of it in these terms, but essentially, okay, maybe I can do for this one. I know I can't do for all these people and for everyone. My roommate at the time was Rick Holliday, who's been on our staff from the very, very beginning, our business administrator, and does all our, just oversees basically everything that has to do with the business side of our church to this day. He was single as well. And I introduced Jane to Rick. And so we kind of took Jane on. She sort of became our mascot. Now, she was a street person. She was a drug addict. She was on a methadone program, but she was also on anything else she'd get her hands on. She wouldn't tell us where she lived. We decided to get her into rehab. And during my time with Jane, in fact, I thought about writing a book, Life with Jane, I learned about Medicare, Medicaid. I went to every rehab place. We spent hundreds that became thousands of dollars in and out of jobs. It went on and on and on. And she just was trying so hard, and we were trying so hard, and we didn't know what we were doing. I'm sure we did it all wrong, and it was just a mess. And she would lie to us, and then she would disappear, then she'd show back up. In fact, she told me one time, she said, "Andy, do you know how to know when an addict is lying?" I said, "How do you know?" She said, "Whenever their lips are moving." She's a drug addict. So anyway, I became way more street smart. I got married during this time, and Sandra met Jane, and Jane just sort of became part of our little entourage as she struggled. And it was horrible, and I'm making light of it, and I got to tell the story quick. But I remember one time, we finally got her a job, and it wasn't a great job, but she couldn't really do anything, and she was just so unstable. And we got her a job, and we found these two college kids who had this house, and they were going to let her stay in one of the rooms for free, which didn't look great, but we needed a place for Jane to stay close to MART Alliance so she could get to work. So anyway, she called me. She'd only had this job like 3 or 4 weeks. She called me. She said, "Well, Andy, I had to quit my job today." I said, "What?" I mean, it was so hard to help her. "What? You quit?" "Yeah." I said, "Why?" And she said, and this is how we talked back then. She said, "I have AIDS." I'm like, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, I tested positive for AIDS. I'm HIV positive." I'm like, I said, "Well, why'd you quit your job?" "Well, I knew if they found out, they were going to fire me, so I went ahead and quit. And I told the guys that you set me up with that I was moving out because I don't want to affect them." I'm like, "Oh, no." "So, well, let's go to a clinic, you know, and get you tested." And so then she disappears for a couple of weeks. Okay, this is just how it went. Then she called me up. Now, there's no cell phones back then, okay? We had car phones. Remember those? Car phones, bag phones, you know. And then some people had those cell phones. It was like the two-handed thing, you know. You could use it as a weapon, you know. So, and she calls me up. She said, "Andy, I gotta meet with you. So we met. Okay, I lied. Okay, we lied about what? I lied about having AIDS. I'm like, wait. You lied about being HIV positive? Yes. Okay, who would lie? Okay, who would make that up? You lied about being HIV? She says, "Yeah." She said, "I knew, because what happened is I'm using again, and I didn't want to tell you I'm using again because you'd be so disappointed, so I made up the story, and that's why I had to quit my job and move out, but I'm back on the street, and I'm using again." I'm like, "Well, honestly, I'm relieved, okay?" So, don't, you know, so anyway, this went on for years, not daily, but weekly, monthly. This went on and on for years. Now, when you have a Jane in your life, you can only do for one, okay? You can't have five or six of these, you know? But we decided we're going long, we're going deep, we're going time, we're going money. And throughout my years with Jane, we would tell her, finally there was a group of us that knew Jane. I would say to her, "Jane, here's what I know is going to happen. If you'll let him, God is going to redeem your pain." She had run away from home. She grew up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Some tough things happened there. She left there, came to Atlanta, hit the streets, had been on the street for years. I said, "If you'll let God, he'll redeem all this. He'll use all this." And she's like, "How in the world?" I said, "I don't know how, but you've got to get clean. You got to stay clean. You got to forgive. And if you do, God is going to redeem all this junk. And the other thing that's going to happen, Jane, one day God's going to take you back to Hattiesburg." She's like, "Never going back to Hattiesburg." I said, "You wait. When you let God have his full, you know, full force work in your life, finish what he's going to do, at the end of the story, God's going to take you back to Hattiesburg." "No, I'm never going back to Hattiesburg." Well, years went by, and she was in church every Sunday listening to my dad, and then we started North Point. She came with us, and she was always at every service. She stayed for every service. She couldn't get enough. She would serve, and finally, she broke her addiction. I mean, she was clean, and that was you've been to AA meetings, I'm sure. I don't know if you've ever been to an NA meeting, Narcotics Anonymous, a CA meeting, Cocaine Anonymous. I've been to all of them, okay? Smoke-filled room. I'm like, "I'm going to have cancer by the time the AA meeting's over." I mean, I met rock stars. I met people I didn't even know lived in Atlanta. I was immersed. And I went to her first meeting. She went to the CA, the Cocaine Anonymous meeting. She didn't do cocaine, but that was the closest thing to her addiction. She felt like she could relate mostly to those people. And there I am in the basement of some church somewhere in downtown Atlanta, smoke-filled room with, you know, freaky cocaine people coming off of that, and it was precious people. I mean, you just couldn't be there and not be brokenhearted and cried. And I gave her chip. Ooh, so emotional. Then a few months later, I was there. I gave her next chip. Once she was clean for a while, she said, "Andy, I want to start a ministry." I said, "I knew this was going to happen." She said, I want to help women who are victims of abuse, especially, and I won't go into detail, I just want to help women who are victims of abuse." I said, "You'd be great at that." She had this little apartment, inexpensive apartment. And so through our church network, she just started meeting ladies. And I would see Jane. She said, "Andy, I want you to meet so-and-so. She's in my group." "Andy, I want you to meet so-and-so. She's in my group." 3 or 4 weeks later, "Andy, this is so-and-so. She's in my group." And Jane started telling me about her group. They would meet every week, and they would rotate different ladies in and out, and it was all about overcoming sexual abuse and views of men and just all those things that women sometimes are forced to deal with. And she'd say, Andy, I want you to come sometime. I'm like, I gave you your chips. I'm not coming to your men-hater, you know, meeting, okay? I love you, Jane, but me and 12 hurting women, I don't know. You know, it just seems weird that I'm the only guy there. No, but, and what she wanted, she was just so proud of what God had done, you know? So she called me one night or day, and she said, look, okay, here's the deal. Next week, I'm having my group, and I'm having the girls invite their boyfriends and their husbands, because I'm going to talk to the men about how to love a woman who's been sexually abused. I'm like, do you even, what? Uneducated, just, I'm like, she said, so there's going to be some other men there, so I want you and Sandra to come. I said, all right, we'll come. So we climb up those metal stairs to her apartment and get in there and meet people, and she starts. We're sitting on the couch, and she's got a circle, and there are only three guys there and about eight ladies. And I sat there for 3 hours with Sandra, and we just watched Jane hold court. It was amazing. I mean, she had her Bible back and forth and back and forth, and one lady was going to tell her whole story, and and we never said anything. And it was over. We got out as fast as we could when the meeting ended, and I'm not exaggerating. Sandra will tell you. We walked down those metal stairs. We didn't say a word to each other. We got in our car, and we both burst out crying. Not teary-eyed, not weeping. And my wife is not a big crier. And I can get weepy over anything. But, I mean, we were honestly, I remember we were sobbing. And part of it was just the emotion of what we had heard in that room that night. But a lot of it was watching Jane. A few months later, it all runs together. She called me giggling. I said, what's up? She said, well, remember how you used to tell me one day I was going to have to go back to Hattiesburg? I said, yep. She said, I need to go back. She goes, I ran away. I got to go back and make things right with some people, especially with my mama. I said, all right. So we had a little party for Jane and sold her car that we never were sure. She had a car, but you still had to pick her up because it didn't work half the time. Packed her up and sent her to Hattiesburg. She re-engaged with what she had run away from many, 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 many years before. And she'd come back and visit. She'd sit on the front row. She'd come to all three services, sing all the songs, hang around, be the last one to leave, hated to leave this church. She loved this church. And she loved the people in this church, but she had to go back. And every time I'd publish a book, I'd send her cases of books. She'd just give them all out, you know. And so this went on and on and on. She had a lot of health problems because she'd so abused her body and been on the street for so many years, lots of health problems. Finally, she called me one day and she said, Andy, I have cancer. She said, it's not good. So we talked and I'd call her and we'd talk, and she made one last trip here. And about 3 years ago, Jane died. Now, she had a brother named Buddy, and I would talk to Buddy during Jane's illness just to know what was going on. And after the funeral, he called me. He said, Andy, he said, you know, Jane didn't have anything, but she had a little bit. She got a job when she went back to Hattiesburg. He said, and she wanted to leave the church something. So once we finish paying all the bills, there won't be much left, but we want to send the church something. She wanted us to leave everything she had left over to the church. The church meant so much to her. So a few weeks later, I get a check in the mail for $6,000 from Jane. To our church. Now, I've gotten bigger checks, but I've never gotten a more precious check than that, because it represented a whole life that had been redeemed, and it represented to me a 20-something-year-old miracle. It represented to me, it was a reminder to me, that as overwhelmed as I get with all the things I can't do anything about, just like you're overwhelmed with things you can't do anything about, that my responsibility isn't to change the world. My responsibility is to go deep and to go long and to go time and to go money and to always be on the lookout for the one, even though I can't do something for everyone. and to be on the lookout for the one and listen to that still small voice, pay attention to that nudge, the Andy, Sandra, family, that's your one. That's your one. And I want you to do for the one what you wish you could do for everyone. So this year, I want you to pay attention. This year, I don't want you to be overwhelmed. This year, I don't want you to go into a hole and hide. This year, I don't want you to just give $10 to everything that comes and goes, okay, and feel good about it. This year, I want you to pay attention and look for the one. Because somewhere along the way, some of you already know who it is. Some of you are already engaged. For some of you, it's adoption. For some of you, it's fostering. For some of you, it's a small group. For some of you, it's calling that couple that's going through that terrible thing and you're thinking, okay, I think about them all the time. I pray for them all the time, but I've never invited them to our home because I'm not a marriage counselor. We're not marriage counselors, but they need somebody in their corner and we're going to get in their corner. And we're going to stay in their corner with them till they run us off because we're going to go deep. We're going to go long. We're going to go time. We're going to go money. We're going to do for one what we wish we could do for everyone. And here's what I think. If everybody did that, it might change the whole world. If everybody did for one what we wish we could do for everyone, it could change the world. But here's what I know for sure. If you do for one what you wish you could do for everyone, it will certainly change somebody's world. And if your experience is anything like mine has been, it'll change your world as well. So we can't run and hide, and we can't be overwhelmed, and we can't grow weary in doing good. We have a margin of time, we have an opportunity, and as God nudges you this year, I hope you'll do for someone what you wish in your heart you could do for everyone. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, thank you for Jane. Thank you for the way that she helped me and Sandra and Rick and Pamela and many others of us see you a little bit differently. Thank you for what we learned about ourselves as we struggled to help her. And as at times we grew weary in doing good and yet knew that we couldn't crawl in a hole and pretend. And Father, as I was speaking, some people came to our minds. Some uncomfortable situations came to our minds. Some things that will demand our time came to our minds, and we know what you want us to do. I pray that we would be extraordinarily generous, but that we would never hide behind our generosity and avoid the time that you want us to give to people who need what we have and people in whose lives we should invest. So Father, in this year, as we accomplish our goals, and this year, as we try to be hold fast to our New Year's resolutions, Father, nudge us, prompt us, whisper to us, and then give us the courage to do for the one what we wish we could do for everyone. And it's in the name of Jesus I ask these things. Amen.